I'll always remember when I was a kid, my folks bought me my first telescope. Just loved it. I even joined a telescope club, and I'd go there on Tuesday nights, and everybody would bring their telescopes and go out there, if weather permitting, and just take a look at the heavens. It was just fascinating. Up next, we talk with a real astronomer, Ken Croswell, on Coast to Coast AM. Well, as I mentioned, Ken Croswell is an astronomer. He has authored 8 books, has become interested in astronomy during first grade. He graduated summa cum laude from Washington University, where he majored in physics and minored in English literature and mathematics. He also earned his PhD in astronomy from Harvard University for studying the Milky Way. During his research, he discovered a halo star located 90,000 light years above the plane of the galaxy. And in addition, he's written for 2 radio programs, Earth and Sky and Stardate. Here he is, Ken Croswell. Hey, Ken, how are you?
Oh, doing pretty well, George. Good. How are you?
Now, Washington University, is that the one in Washington or in St. Louis?
That's definitely the one in St. Louis.
That's right near me.
That's right.
I'm there a lot. It's a great university, by the way, Ken.
Yes, indeed. Yes, it is.
It's super. And, you know, I've got your latest work, The Lives of Stars, and just superb. Hubble did a lot of that ISO?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. The images, I selected the very best color images from anywhere I could get them, but many of them do indeed come from the Hubble Space Telescope. And then I asked an astrophotographer, an outstanding astrophotographer by the name of Tony Hallis, to digitally reprocess the images to bring out the very best color and sharpness. And you see the stunning results there on the page.
As an astronomer, I've got to ask you about asteroids for a moment. How are we doing there? We're going to get zapped one day?
Well, one day, it's inevitable, unless, of course, we do a proper survey and try to discover everything out there that crosses the Earth's orbit. As you know, the dinosaurs got knocked off 65 million years ago by an asteroid that was just about 6 miles across. And so what we astronomers want to do is simply detect everything that's out there that crosses the Earth's orbit, and then, you know, those things that will pose a threat in the far future, we can develop some plans for. But yeah, it's inevitable. I mean, if you look at our solar system, you see all the craters on, you know, the moon, Mercury.
Oh, they're everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And they would be everywhere on Earth too, except Earth has so much erosion that you know, the craters are most of them are washed away. But yeah, it's asteroids are definitely a threat. I wouldn't lose sleep over them, but it makes sense to search and find every asteroid we can that crosses the Earth's path.
I assume in the infancy of the solar system, all these objects got hit more than they are now. Is that correct?
That's true. There was a lot more debris early on in the solar system's life, a lot more comets and asteroids roaming space, and then they got gathered up into the planets. And also Jupiter and Saturn helped us out. They kicked a lot of objects out of the solar system altogether. So, yeah, today the solar system is a safer place to live today than it was 4 billion years ago. That's true.
That's a good thing, too, Ken.
Yes, indeed.
Sure is. What is your fascination, specifically with astronomy, but what area do you just love?
Well, I'm pretty broad. I like the planets. I like the stars. I like the galaxies. I did my PhD on the Milky Way. What got me interested in astronomy in the very first place, back in first grade, as you mentioned, were the planets. One morning, my first grade teacher introduced us to the planets of the solar system. I was just fascinated that there were other planets out there, and they all had different colors. For example, Venus is white, Mars is orange, Saturn is yellow, and so forth. Those two things are what really hooked me. And now I think what fascinates me the most is simply the enormous diversity of objects and the beauty of those objects out there in space. For example, you know, a lot of people think all stars are the same, but in fact, stars are incredibly diverse. I mean, you've got red stars, blue stars, yellow stars, old stars, young stars, big stars, tiny stars. I mean, some stars are smaller than a city on Earth. Some stars are so big, if you put them in place of the sun, they would stretch all the way out to the planet Jupiter. The universe is a very diverse place.
I'll always remember my earliest telescope where I turned it on Saturn, and Ken, you would think I just found $10 million. I mean, it was awesome looking through my telescope at this planet with a little ring around it. And then I turned it on to Jupiter, and I saw the 4 major moons. That was incredible. And then I saw Mars and Venus. I'm telling you, it's gorgeous.
We've got some great planets in the solar system, although I think Earth probably tops them all, if you think about it.
I think so, too. I think so, too. As we look for more stars that could be supporting planets that are Earth-like with possibly intelligent life, how do we go about that? And how do you as an astronomer look for that ideal star?
Well, we only have one example of a planet that has that we know has life. Now, that one example, of course, is the Earth. And the Sun, obviously, is the star that the Earth goes around. And so our first inclination tends to be to try to focus on those stars that are similar to the Sun. And contrary to what you may have heard, the Sun is not an average star. Most stars in the galaxy are much fainter than the Sun. Most stars, in fact, 75% of all stars in the universe are these small, faint things called red dwarfs. In fact, the very nearest individual star to the Sun, Proxima Centauri, is a red dwarf. And stars like the Sun, which are yellow G-type main sequence stars, make up only about 4% of all the stars in the galaxy. And so when we think about which stars in the universe, which stars in our galaxy might be supporting life, we naturally focus on those stars that are similar to the Sun in that 4% category. And we do have some stars nearby. You know, 4% means 1 in 25 stars is like the Sun. The Alpha Centauri system is especially interesting. Alpha Centauri is, of course, the nearest star system to the Sun. It's just a bit over 4 light years away. And it's actually a triple star. It consists of 3 stars. The brightest of those 3 stars is called Alpha Centauri A. And it, amazingly, it is very similar to the Sun. Exact same temperature, exact same color, exact same spectral type. Luminosity is a bit more. But it's a very promising star. And then going around that star every 80 years is a star that's somewhat fainter than the Sun. It's an orange dwarf star called Alpha Centauri B. But both of those stars are quite promising. And then very far from those two stars, you've got this red dwarf called Proxima Centauri that goes around them. And there is definitely sufficient room in the Alpha Centauri system to have planets. With orbits similar to those of Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars going around each of the 2 bright stars in the Alpha Centauri system. And furthermore, we know that Alpha Centauri is a bit older than the Sun, and that's something that we like to see in a star, because a very young star won't have had time to develop planets with intelligent life. I mean, for example, 4 billion years ago, I mean, the Earth was here, but it didn't have intelligent life. So Alpha Centauri certainly had plenty of time to develop intelligent life on its planet, if it has planets. That's the big unknown. We don't know.
We don't know that yet.
We don't know that yet. And there is a fear that maybe Alpha Centauri has no planets at all. Here's the reason the fear exists. Alpha Centauri A and B orbit each other every 80 years. So they're, you know, at their closest to each other, they're a bit farther apart than Saturn is from the Sun. And the fear is that... Let me back up. The planets of our solar system formed in a disk of gas and dust going around the young Sun. And the fear is that the gravity of Alpha Centauri B may have disrupted the disk of gas and dust that was trying to develop planets around Alpha Centauri A, and vice versa, so that no planets formed around either of those stars. But we do know that there are stable orbits around those stars, and by stable orbit, I mean if you place a planet at Earth's distance from the Sun, at that same distance from either Alpha Centauri A or Alpha Centauri B, it'll keep going around that star just fine. It won't get disrupted by the other star. But right now, as you say, we do not know if Alpha Centauri has planets. What we do know is that there are more than 400 planets that we know of that go around other stars, stars beyond our own solar system.
Now, in our case, Ken, if we happen to have been where Venus is or Mars, will we still have the kind of life we have on this planet today if we were in those locations?
It's in the case of Venus, almost certainly not. Venus is so close to the Sun, and it's just terribly hot. And it is possible that long ago, Venus itself may have had oceans the way the Earth does. But today, Venus is an extremely hostile planet, has a surface temperature of 860 degrees Fahrenheit. So had the Earth been in Venus's location, I think it's extremely unlikely that we'd have life on Earth today. Now, you put the Earth in Mars's location, and there's a chance that life might have continued. Mars, see, here's a big difference between Venus and Earth on the one hand and Mars on the other. Venus and Earth are almost exactly the same size and mass, but Mars is a good deal smaller than Earth. It's only about half the size of the Earth. And some people think that had Mars been larger, had it been the size of Earth, or maybe a bit larger than Earth, it would actually have been able to maintain a thicker atmosphere, which would have caused a stronger greenhouse effect so that it would be able to stay warmer than it is now. Mars is a very, very cold planet because it's 50% farther from the sun than the Earth is. So if it had a thicker atmosphere with more carbon dioxide, then and water vapor, then the atmosphere itself would be able to trap heat from the sun. And one reason that Mars lost its atmosphere is that the volcanoes of Mars does have volcanoes, but those volcanoes no longer erupt, or if they do erupt, they erupt very rarely. And volcanoes give off gases that give a planet atmosphere. So it's certainly possible that if Earth had been in Mars's location, it might have stayed warm enough to have life to the state.
So what are the odds of, one, Earth being where it is, which is ideal for life the way we know it, and two, for life to have happened? I mean, both of these, I don't believe in coincidences, Ken. Both of these aren't they astronomical?
Well, if you think about it, we have got three planets, Venus, Earth, and Mars, that are, roughly in the ballpark of the right distance from the sun. And the fact that one of those planets happens to be the right distance from the sun, I don't think is all that unusual. In other words, if other solar systems out there have a similar layout, then I would not be surprised if many of those other solar systems happen to have a planet similar to Earth that's more or less the right distance from its star to have a mild climate. And by mild climate, I mean a good temperature that allows water to exist in liquid form. That seems to be a chief requirement for life. Now, you then ask a much harder to answer question, which is, what is the chance of life then arising on a good planet? So let's imagine we have a good planet. We've got a planet like Earth at the right distance from its star, so it's warm, it's got a nice atmosphere, it's got water in liquid form. What's the chance that life is going to arise on that planet? And the honest answer is we have no idea. We don't know if it happens inevitably, in other words, every time, or if it happens only one in a trillion times. And until we find other planets out there that have life, we aren't going to know the answer to that question. And that's one of the main reasons we want to find planets out there that have life, or, we may search a million planets and find that none of them have life. And that'll tell us, hey, maybe we're alone in the universe.
Do you think we're alone, Ken, in the universe?
I honestly don't know, and I tell people we should always keep an open mind. Either way, it's profound. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, the fact that right now there might be other civilizations out there in our galaxy, possibly, for all we know, as near as Alpha Centauri, I mean, that's fascinating. But on the other hand, you look out at all those stars out there and all the galaxies beyond our galaxy, imagine if not a single one of those stars has any intelligent life. Imagine if we are the only intelligent life in the universe. That's almost equally profound, I think.
I would think that it would probably be incredibly profound if we were alone, just alone, in all this vastness.
Yes, and in a way, it would almost give us a great responsibility to the rest of the universe, because there very well may be lots of planets out there that have life, but that have not developed intelligent life,
right,
the way the Earth is. So imagine if we, shocking though it might seem, if we, primitive though we and primitive and barbaric though human beings have often been, imagine if we are the most advanced life in the galaxy.
Can we assume that most of these planets that are Earth-like, that may be out there, most of which we haven't found, will probably possess water?
Well, if we look, it depends what you mean by Earth-like. If you mean simply a planet that's similar in size and mass to the Earth, I mean, we've got Venus, which is very similar in size and mass to the Earth. It has essentially no water at all. Mars has some water, but the water is all frozen. Water is actually quite a common substance. It's simply hydrogen and oxygen, which are two of the most common elements in the universe. In fact, those rings of Saturn that you saw through your telescope, they're made of water, except it's frozen water.
Right, frozen.
The thing that makes the Earth so special is the right temperature to have water in liquid form. So yes. I think what you're asking is, are there planets out there like Earth that have got water in liquid form? And I think that depends on the planet being the right distance from its star. I think there almost certainly are planets out there in the size of Earth that have water in liquid form, simply because water is such a very common substance in the universe.
What do you find to be the most fascinating thing in the universe right now, Ken, as an astronomer?
Well, the discovery of all these new planets is one of the most fascinating things. We call these planets extrasolar planets, in the same way that extraordinary means beyond the ordinary. So extrasolar means beyond the solar system. And we're finding that these planets are very strange. We have not yet found an Earth-like planet, even though we know of more than 400 extrasolar planets right now, but not a single one is really what you call Earth-like. The very first planets we found, believe it or not, back in 1991, were discovered around a pulsar, which is a collapsed star, a dead star, very, very dissimilar to the sun. And then we've also found a lot of giant planets similar to Jupiter going around other stars like the sun. But many of these Jupiter-like planets are in very tight orbits, very close to their stars.
Well, I got to tell you, that's all dramatic. It's exciting. What happens next with technology, Ken? What are we going to find and how?
Well, in March of last year, NASA launched the Kepler spacecraft, which is going to be looking for the tiny eclipses that that planets cause as they go around their stars. And the hope is that after a three-year period, we're going to be discovering not just Jupiter-like planets, but Earth-sized planets going around stars similar to the sun. And furthermore, some of these planets, some of these Earth-like planets, are going to have distances from their stars of about 93 million miles. So some of these planets are going to be the right temperature to have liquid water. And I think the Kepler mission is going to tell us a lot about the prevalence of Earth-like planets in the universe. And then we can study those planets to see if they've got atmospheres that indicate that the planets have water and maybe even life.
Those who want to get The Lives of Stars, where do they get the book?
Oh, The Lives of Stars is a brand new book. It should be in all online bookstores as well as any good bookstore out in the real world.
And your website?
It's simply kencroswell.com.
All right, Ken, great work, by the way, just putting all of this together. If you weren't an astronomer, what would you be doing?
Well, I don't know. When I was a kid, I had a great interest in meteorology as well. So I guess I've always liked the sky. So who knows? I might be forecasting the weather right now.
Indeed. Really. Well, I hope technology continues to grow, and I bet you're glad Hubble's still cooking, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The Hubble Space Telescope continues to perform wonderfully. It was launched in 1990, so it's been around about 20 years now. So it's told us a lot about the universe. It's taken many of the beautiful images that you see in The Lives of Stars, and it does a lot of excellent science. And, of course, there are great observatories right here on Earth as well.
Do you think we'll ever see the first light of the universe?
Well, in a sense, we did see the first light of the universe in the cosmic microwave background. That's sort of the afterglow of the Big Bang. It dates back to a period a mere 400,000 years after the Big Bang, which is the big explosion that gave rise to our universe about 14 billion years ago.
All right, we're going to take some phone calls next with a real astronomer, Ken Croswell. So if you have any questions about space, it's your turn next. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, two special guests. Kyle Laverne joins us as we talk about Appalachian case studies of UFOs, along with the father of modern-day ufology, Stanton Friedman, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, have you signed up yet for the After Dark magazine? You can by calling 1-888-727-5505. You can also go online at coasttocoastam.com. Full color. It's called the After Dark magazine. Okay, welcome back to Coast. We're with astronomer Ken Croswell, and we'll take your phone calls for the remaining portion of this half hour. Ken, as an astronomer, what is being done now for asteroid, for example, protection? Yeah, I just noticed that another object went by here, a very small 33-metered object, probably space junk, who knows? But are we watching the skies properly?
Well, we are definitely watching the skies, and we astronomers would like to discover and catalog everything that crosses the Earth's orbit. And in fact, just a month ago, a new spacecraft was launched called the WISE spacecraft, and that's a spacecraft that's going to be focused on the infrared, which is a wavelength a bit longer than those of visible light. And it's going to be detecting lots of things, but one thing it's going to be detecting are these near-Earth asteroids that we don't know about. So, you know, we really want to know everything that's out there to make sure that there's nothing on a collision course with the Earth.
All right, to the calls we go. We'll pick it up by going to Don in Oregon, west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast, Don. You're up with us.
Hello, boys.
Hey.
Happy New Year.
You too, Donald.
Ken, first off, I've got a 4-year-old granddaughter and a 2-year-old granddaughter and a 6-month-old granddaughter, and George knows this story. But I get the astronomy magazine, and whenever they come down here, which is like 1 week out of a month or whatever, the 4-year-old goes, "Poppy, where's the new astronomy magazine? She knows what a nebula is, what a galaxy is.
Wow.
All that good, happy stuff. And she's teaching her 2-year-old sister, because she'll, you know, lay out the magazine and tell her what this stuff is. But my question is, I bought them a 6-inch diameter telescope. The wife says, you bought it for yourself. I said, okay, you know, give you a break there. But what is the best magnification eyepiece I can use on that thing to get it a little closer, you know, to a celestial object?
Well, I would I usually advocate, especially for kids and for beginners, I advocate just using a pair of binoculars, because a pair of binoculars, you can see so much.
I've got those, too.
Okay, great, great.
I'm driving these kids nuts.
Okay, great, great. And in terms of the proper eyepiece, this is kind of outside my area of expertise, but I would just try experimenting. And maybe even, since you're in Oregon, are you anywhere near Portland by any chance?
Well, I'm in Salem, which is about an hour away.
Okay, because there's a very large astronomy group that meets on the first Monday of every month in Portland. And that's the Rose City Astronomers. And you could get advice there. They meet at OMSI on Monday nights.
Right, because I'm driving my neighbors nuts with this. Last summer, I took the telescope across the street, because we've got a lot of trees, because I'm in Oregon. And kids were lining up to look through this thing, and we watched Jupiter. We could only see 2 of the moons, but it was way cool. Even the adults came out here and looked at this thing.
Oh, that's fantastic. That is fantastic.
Hey, you know, I've read about you. You do excellent work, man, and because of people like you, these children, my children, my granddaughters or whatever, they're learning astronomy and science and all that stuff, and I really appreciate what you do, and I appreciate this show.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Don. I want to tell you one thing. If you can get a hold of the February issue of Highlights for Children, which isn't quite out yet, you'll be able to read an article I wrote about the discovery of the newest moons around Pluto. I think your kids will love that one.
Super. So if they find oxygen on outside planets, what are the odds of life then? What do you think?
The odds then are actually pretty good. The reason there's oxygen in our air is because there is life on Earth. Oxygen is a very unstable element, and it quickly combines with the surface of a planet if there's no life. The only reason there's oxygen in our air is because those trees in Oregon and elsewhere on Earth are pumping oxygen into the atmosphere. So if we find a planet that's got oxygen in its air, that will be a very strong sign that there's life there. There's no planet in our solar system except Earth that has a large amount of oxygen in its air.
Okay, next up, we go to Cleveland, Ohio. Hello, Terry, go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hi.
Mr. Craswell. My question is, you know, we have the Hubble telescope, and you can look, you know, it can look hundreds of thousands of light years away and everything. And this might be a dumb question, but why can't we just take that and zoom it into, say, the moon to look at the lunar landing areas? Or even, George, your friend Jasper P. Warren had that amazing video of that chimney-like thing that was spouting like a vapor.
Right, right.
You know, in the air. And I just wonder, why we can't zoom in real close with the Hubble with that. And I'll take my answer on the radio.
Sure thing.
Well, the Hubble Space Telescope, believe it or not, is actually a rather small telescope by modern standards. It achieves its great resolution because it's above the distorting effects of the Earth's atmosphere. But there are still some things that it just can't see. I mean, for example, it can't really see. I mean, we have images of Pluto from the Hubble Space Telescope, but they don't show anything simply because Pluto is so small. And likewise, if it were to look at the Moon, the lunar landing sites are just so very small that it's not going to be able to see them. Believe it or not, there are some things beyond Hubble's capability. In the case of Pluto, I'm happy to tell you that we have just sent a spacecraft to Pluto, and it will be reaching Pluto in 2015, and that's going to give us our first close-up view of Pluto and its three known moons.
Very good. Darren in Jonesboro, Tennessee is our next caller. He's to the Rockies. Hey, Darren, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and good
sure.
morning, George.
Good morning.
Quick question for Ken. What can you tell us about gamma ray bursts in general, with the understanding that GRBs are pretty well a pretty rich topic that could probably eat up an entire 3-hour show? And WR-104 in particular, the so-called death star that apparently is pointed directly at us. And I'll clear the line and take my answer off the phone. Thanks very much.
Okay. Gamma ray bursts, Ken.
Yeah, well, I'm not losing any sleep over them. But there seem to be two main sources of these gamma ray bursts. One seems to be just supernova explosions, explosions of stars, of massive stars at the ends of their lives. Most supernova explosions don't produce these gamma ray bursts, but a few do. And the few that do tend to occur in galaxies that are quite different from ours. And that's one reason I don't lose too much sleep over them, including this WR star that the caller mentioned. And some of the gamma ray bursts also occur when you have two black holes in orbit around each other and they merge together, or you might have two neutron stars in orbit around each other and they merge. These are very rare events, but because the universe is vast, so we see a gamma ray burst occur, you know, about once a day someplace in the universe.
Next up, we go to John in Baltimore, Maryland. It's your turn. John, go ahead.
Good morning, guys.
Morning.
How are you today?
Good.
Good. I wanted to ask, your bumper music triggered my question, playing the Rush. I heard, I think it was last year, they found an Earth-like planet outside of the constellation of Cygnus. I saw that online. Might have even possibly been on your website.
Okay, well, there are no planets outside the solar system that have yet been found that are Earth-like. However, the Kepler spacecraft, which was launched last March, is looking in the constellation Cygnus and Lyra for planets similar to Earth. However, it's probably going to take it a few years to do what it's doing, because in order to find a truly Earth-like planet with an Earth-like orbit, you want an orbit that it takes about 1 year. We found a lot of planets that are much bigger than Earth that have much shorter periods. But in order to really see the planet, you want to detect it around more than one cycle. So it's going to take several years to detect these Earth-like planets and then to confirm them. So we have not yet discovered any Earth-like planets outside our solar system. But I have every reason to think that Kepler is, in the next 3 years, is going to be discovering literally hundreds of these Earth-like planets.
Okay. Hey, one real quick question.
Sure.
While you're out there looking at the stars, have you ever seen anything just fly by that you're like, what was that?
Well, I've seen meteors. I mean, they're very nice to look at. A bright meteor or fireball are wonderful things to see. And yeah, those are amazing.
Ken, how are we with teaching astronomy in school now these days in this country?
I fear we're not doing a very good job. I actually gave a school presentation a little while ago, and before I gave the presentation a week earlier, I asked the teacher, I didn't want to repeat anything that they already knew, and he told me, you know what, these kids don't know anything about astronomy. They're not taught anything about astronomy these days, and so I was able to teach them the planets of our solar system and not have to fear that I was repeating anything they knew. But I do fear that we're not teaching the kids in school astronomy so much as we did 30 or 40 years ago.
Is it because they're not interested, the kids?
Oh, the kids love it when you teach them astronomy.
I would think so.
Yeah, no, kids are kids. I mean, they still have the sense of wonder that you and I did when we were kids. But I suspect it's the teachers that, they're being forced to sort of stick to the basics, and astronomy for some reason is not considered one of the basics. But my theory is, if you can get a kid excited about something, it doesn't have to be astronomy, but astronomy is a great topic to get a kid excited about. I mean, the kid will then go to the library, read about it, develop his reading skills, develop his math skills if it's a subject like as astronomy is that requires some knowledge of mathematics. And, that can inspire the kid to learn about lots of other things, too. So I think, just focusing on the basics is a mistake. And I do think that teachers, especially in elementary school, ought to be introducing their children, ought to be exposing their children to the wonders of the universe. And that's one of the reasons I wrote my book, The Lives of Stars, because it's not just for adults, but it's for kids as well.
Let's go to Sharon in Beaumont, California, west of the Rockies. Hey, Sharon, welcome.
Thank you. Sure. Pleasure to speak with you. My question is about rotation, and is everything rotating differently, including the whole universe, or just our solar system, or does everything choose its own rotation and decide what to do? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
All right. Can you help her there, Ken?
I think I can, yeah. In general, things rotate. We don't know if the universe is rotating, but our Earth is rotating. The sun is rotating. It rotates once every month. The entire galaxy is rotating because all the stars are going around the center of the galaxy. Our galaxy is probably orbiting around, there are galaxies that are orbiting around our galaxy. Things, other stars out there in space definitely rotate. We can detect that. We can detect how fast they're rotating. So yes, in general, things out there are rotating. Galaxies, stars, planets, moons, they're all doing their rotation thing.
All right. Next up, we go to Lexington, Kentucky, home of the Red Mile. Hey, Don, go ahead.
Hey, good morning, George.
Hi.
And Dr. Croswell. George, by the way, thank you for your service to your country. I was a Navy guy, too.
You're welcome. Thank you, Doug.
Dr. Croswell, your comment earlier regarding you just weren't sure about life in other places. So does that mean that you're not necessarily a believer in the UFO phenomenon, sir?
No. I've never been convinced by that. That doesn't mean that there can't be other life out there. I mean, there are so many stars. There are hundreds of billions of stars in our galaxy alone, and we now know that many of those stars have planets, and we have not yet detected an Earth-like planet, but I suspect the Kepler spacecraft is going to be doing that in the next few years. So there's many possible abodes for alien life, but I'm not convinced by these UFO reports at all.
All right, so thank you all. Have a good evening.
Okay, next up we have Eddie, truck driving in Arizona. Hey, Eddie, go ahead.
I wanted to ask you, I got a pair of binoculars, and I drive across the Arizona a lot. And I wanted to know, is there a telescope that's worth buying for about $1,000?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Ken?
That's the right answer, George.
Yeah.
Yes. And in fact, you could probably get a good telescope for a few hundred dollars. You don't want to pay too little, because then you get a piece of junk.
Yeah, $350 is pretty good too, right? Right around there?
Yeah, that seems like a good price.
Absolutely.
What I would do...
Hey, what do you recommend, though, Ken? The refractor or the reflector? And tell us the difference.
Well, it all depends on what you're interested in observing, okay? So I think what you need to do is get into astronomy sufficiently so that maybe you want to observe planets. I mean, for that, refractors are great. Or maybe instead you want to observe star clusters and nebulae. For that, reflectors are better. But I think you sort of need to decide what it is you want to concentrate on in astronomy. And since you're in Arizona, there's a lot of amateur astronomy groups in Arizona. And I would just go to their meetings. Their meetings are free. And talk to other people that own telescopes, get their advice, get their suggestions. And you never know. You might meet somebody who's trying to sell a telescope because he's upgrading to a bigger telescope. You might be able to get a 6 or 8 inch telescope used in that way.
Let's go to our final caller, Charles in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Go ahead, Charles, real quickly.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I was wondering about the search for planets, if it's only happening in our galaxy, or are we searching other galaxies? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Go ahead, Kenny.
We're only searching in our galaxy. Our galaxy is a huge galaxy. It's not an average galaxy. Every star you can see with the unaided eye belongs to our galaxy. So our galaxy alone is more than a big enough place to be searching for planets. So we're only searching in our galaxy right now.
What's new, Ken, beyond, let's say, the next 20 years? Where does astronomy take us?
I think extrasolar planets are going to be one of the big things. Also, we want to figure out why it is the universe's expansion is accelerating. That was a discovery that was made a little over 10 years ago. It really startled people. We expected that the universe's expansion would be slowing down under the influence of the gravity of all the galaxies. And instead, we have found it's actually accelerating. We don't know why. And so I think astronomers and scientists are going to try to figure out that puzzle.
All right. Good luck with your work, The Lives of Stars. It's fun. It's fun to be an astronomer, and it's fun to write these.
Thank you, George. Thank you.
All right, Ken. You take care. Ken Croswell, he did a great job. Very pictorial book, by the way. If you like that, The Lives of Stars. If you want to email me, fire away at george@coast2coastam.com. We've got a great program in store for you tomorrow, and, of course, we'll have our open lines on Friday. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everybody.